Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. This is a weekend special. Back with us is a frequent guest on this show, USA Today Washington Bureau Chief Susan Page. Usually she comes on to explain what's happening in national politics, and she'll do some of that today, but stop the presses. Susan also has a major new biography of the Speaker of the House. It's called Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi and the Lessons of Power. Hi, Susan. Congratulations on the book, which is getting great reviews, and welcome back, as always, to WNYC.
Hey, Brian, thank you. It's always so good to be with you.
Let's talk about the book first, and we'll get into some news of the day later. I saw one review that said something like, I'm doing this from memory and I'm paraphrasing, but it was something like, your book is the kind of big historical figure biography that's usually written about men. And I'm curious if you thought of it that way explicitly when you were writing it.
Well, one reason I was drawn to the subject was I thought that Nancy Pelosi had done things that if she were a man, she would have gotten more credit for. In a way, the fact that she has been a groundbreaker in terms of gender has meant that I think some people don't see what a groundbreaker she has been in terms of actually enacting policy, leading politics, as having done consequential things. She's in the history books, of course, as the first woman speaker. She should be in the history books as well for some of the things she's done in that role.
Well, go ahead. You set that up. Pick some.
All right. Let me pick two. One, 2008 financial meltdown. It was Nancy Pelosi who bailed out a Republican president, George W. Bush, and the nation's economy by pushing through a really unpopular piece of legislation. She blamed that vote for the TARP bill, the Toxic Assets Relief Program, for the defeat of Democrats in the midterm elections in 2010. Hmm. A second example, the Affordable Care Act, would not have been passed without Barack Obama, would not have been passed without Nancy Pelosi, who insisted on going big when some in the White House wanted to go small, and pushed it through in an example of political muscle like we have rarely seen in our country.
On the Affordable Care Act, I noticed that the LA Times review of your book liked your description of Pelosi trying to recruit Indiana Senator Joe Donnelly, not an obvious supporter, anybody coming from Indiana, of, you know, a big health care bill. Would you tell that story and what it's emblematic of?
Well, so he was one of the Democrats who voted against the bill the first time around. They really needed his vote when it came around the second time, when they were using reconciliation, that obscure procedure with which we're all so familiar these days. And Barack Obama called him to the White House and said, you should do this for me. Don't be the vote that keeps me from getting this passed. That did not persuade Congressman Donnelly to vote for the bill. Nancy Pelosi did something different, more subtle, more sophisticated. She called the Reverend Theodore Herzberg, who was, of course, the famous president of Notre Dame, where Joe Donnelly had attended school. Father Herzberg was like a father to him. And Father Herzberg called him and said, I'm not going to tell you how to vote. I know that you're going to do the right thing. And that persuaded Joe Donnelly to vote for this bill. At that point, every single vote was crucial, and it was not helpful for him in his political future.
That's so interesting, and it's an example of what I think you call in the book, knowing people's districts better than they do. Most people probably don't know that Pelosi's father was mayor of Baltimore. So who was he, and what kind of political household did Nancy Pelosi grow up in?
So, Brian, it's so interesting. As we speak, Speaker Pelosi is having her weekly news conference, and I was watching the beginning of it before I was on the air here. She brought a picture of her father to that weekly news conference.
Today.
A picture of her father today. I mean, she's still speaking. Her news conference is still going on, and she's got a picture of her dad up there because he was, before he was the three-term mayor of Baltimore, he was the five-term congressman from Baltimore, and he was chair of the D.C. Appropriations Subcommittee, which meant he was, in effect, the mayor of D.C. And the picture that she showed is one that hangs in her office, it shows him with Eleanor Roosevelt, the first time a first lady ever testified before Congress at his invitation about the situation in the District of Columbia. She brought this to the news conference. She was making the point that the issue of D.C. statehood is something she said is in her DNA. Well, politics is in her DNA because she is very much the daughter of Tommy the Elder D'Alessandro, who was a larger-than-life figure in an era when big city mayors were kingmakers.
So she's from Baltimore, but Pelosi's district is in San Francisco. How'd she wind up there?
Well, she married Paul Pelosi. They were college sweethearts here in D.C. He went to Georgetown University. She went to Trinity College. They moved to New York first, where he had a job. She was then having 5 children in 6 years, which is a pretty rapid pace. He was from a prominent San Francisco family. They moved back there when he had a job offer that involved business with something new. A new business going on in what became known as Silicon Valley. And so she moved to San Francisco. But, you know, in a way, it's San Francisco had some characteristics that were like Baltimore in that port city, really active politics, politics as a contact sport in the city, Democratic politics in particular. So it was a place she felt pretty at home.
So she was getting into the family business, but was there an issue or were there a couple of issues that really motivated her to get into politics herself to try to bring change on?
She never stopped being active as a political volunteer, even in New York when she had all those little kids. And in San Francisco, she eventually became close to Jerry Brown. She became chairman of the California Democratic Party. But the way she got into elective politics as a candidate herself was a way that is familiar, I think, to a lot of women of her generation. She only ran for office after another woman encouraged her to do so. And that woman was Sala Burton, who was the widow of the legendary head of the Burton political machine in California. She had succeeded her husband in Congress. She was dying of cancer. She knew Nancy Pelosi well. She called her in and urged her to run for her seat when it was vacant and offered her endorsement. And Pelosi told me that if Sala Burton had not encouraged her to run, she never would have gotten into elective politics herself.
I want to play a clip from one of the most famous things I think that she did while Trump was president. So obviously she was Speaker of the House, Donald Trump was president. They were big foils for each other. And in one of the years that President Trump gave a State of the Union address, and remember, listeners, how the staging is for a State of the Union address, the Speaker of the House sits behind the president. So that's regardless of party. And therefore, Nancy Pelosi was on camera a lot of the time that Donald Trump was giving his State of the Union addresses. And at the end of it, one year, she tore up the physical copy of the script that she had. And later she explained it like this.
And I got past like about a third of it, and I thought, this is terrible. And I made a niche in a couple pages thinking, I ought to remember what's on this page, on this page. And then I realized that almost every page had something in it that was objectionable. So it wasn't a planned thing, but it was one of my disappointments is the fact that with all that we have done legislatively, whether it's equal pay for equal work, raising the minimum wage, gun violence protection, issues that relate to our children, the list goes on, climate action now, we have very little press on it. And it seems that if you want to get press, you have to get attention. So I thought, well, let's get attention on the fact that what he said here today was not true.
Speaker Pelosi, as we continue with Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, who's got a brand new book called Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi and the Lessons of Power. Does that incident represent a larger political calculation that leaders frequently have to make or that Pelosi has during her career about when to alienate some people who might think you were being too hostile, like tearing up the State of the Union address? And too partisan, and when that gets you something politically or just alienates people?
You know, I don't take Speaker Pelosi's explanation of that totally at face value. I think she lost her temper. You know, she got under Donald Trump's skin over and over again. That was the only occasion I've seen that Donald Trump got under her skin in public. And she did something that she's never expressed regret about it, at least not to me. And I talked to her at length about this episode. But I don't think that it was as much of a calculation as she was steaming by the end of that speech. Part of it was that he had said a series of things that she thought weren't true. Part of it was that he had given a great presidential honor to Rush Limbaugh, who is, of course, so toxic, was such a toxic figure for Democrats. And the other thing was she told me that it got started because she couldn't find a pen. You know, she's sitting up there, right? You don't take a purse up with you when you're sitting behind the president for the State of the Union. She said that before she started to tear the little edges of the speech, she wanted just to make a mark with a pen, but she couldn't find one. There's a little drawer up there. She opened the drawer. It was empty. That got her started on the tearing the edge. By the end of it, she was pretty mad. Her caucus was enraged. That was States of the Union are supposed to be big traditional affairs. They've become pretty partisan. You remember the "you lie" shout that Barack Obama got at one. This was an example of, I think, of her just losing her temper.
For being genuine and still, you know, after all she's been through, she could be jaded. For being able to be moved that much, to that much anger by that many lies.
Yes, that's one way to see it. Another way to see it is it was just an extraordinary show of disrespect and a sign of kind of where our politics are these days.
Mm. So there's Pelosi's relationship with the right, exemplified by that, but there's also Pelosi's relationship with the left in your book, like with the Squad, the young progressive members of Congress, led by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Here's a clip of Pelosi with Leslie Stahl on CBS on 60 Minutes that pertains to that.
Why haven't you brought young people into the leadership?
Because we have. You perhaps don't know.
Why does AOC complain that you have not been grooming younger people for leadership?
I don't know. You'll have to ask her. Because we are.
That was kind of sharp, kind of dismissing her.
Boop. I'm not dismissing her. I respect her. I think she's very effective, as are many other members in our caucus that the press doesn't pay attention to. But they are there, and they are building support for what comes next.
Susan, put that clip in context.
Well, I think that the speaker and AOC have a complicated relationship. And one that has had some ups and downs. You know, in an interview that I did with Speaker Pelosi that happened to fall on the day of a big blow up in the Democratic caucus after the four members of the Squad defected on an immigration bill. And then AOC's then chief of staff posted some really politically incendiary tweets that criticized Pelosi and criticized other Democrats in the House. I happened to be sitting down with her just after that meeting took place. It was, again, an example where she was pretty irate. You know, she's so disciplined that it's rare that you see her not in her most disciplined mode. In this interview, she compared AOC and the Squad to children who want to take holy pictures, want to show how pious and pure they are. Meanwhile, she said, in another part of the room are the people who are here to get things done.
Oh, I saw that quote from your book. Some people come here, as former House Appropriations Chair David Obey would have said, so she's quoting a former congressman, some people come here to pose for holy pictures. See how perfect I am and pure. Okay, there's a group that's going to go pose for holy pictures. Now let's legislate over here. They'll understand when they have something they want to pass. If you have something that you want to pass, you're better off not having your chief of staff send out a tweet in the manner in which that was sent out, totally inappropriate. So that phrase, posing for holy pictures.
That is not a compliment.
Yeah.
Even, even for a devout Catholic like Nancy Pelosi, that is not praise.
How about Monty in Manhattan? You're on WNYC. Hi, Monty.
Oh, hi, Brian. Hi, Susan. My question is, when Pelosi wanted to become Speaker, lots of progressives opposed her, especially AOC, and she made a deal with them. She would be Speaker for only 2 terms and step down. Now, that's coming very soon. I mean, did she pick any heir apparent? Did she pick any replacement? And what's her future?
So, Monty, thanks for your call. That's exactly right. In 2018, when she faced a battle to be reelected Speaker, when Democrats regained the House, she made an offer that she would serve only 2 more terms, only 4 more years. And it was never codified. It's not like somebody could enforce it. But she indicated this year that she intended to, that she remembered her comments and she intended to abide by them. That makes this her valedictory term. This means this is her last term as Speaker of the House, and we assume that would mean her last term in Congress. There are any number of House Democrats who would like to succeed her, and I would think the leading candidate is someone who's very close to home for you all, and that is Hakeem Jeffries, the congressman from Brooklyn. He's in the leadership now. He is close to Pelosi. He would be a groundbreaker in his own way. If he became the House Democratic leader, he would be the first person of color to hold that role.
Your last book. Nanti, go ahead.
And Pelosi will retire or will stay? Will still stay in the Congress?
So she hasn't said, Monty, but I can't imagine she would stay in Congress. She indicated when she first came to Congress that she only wanted to stay for 5 terms, 10 years. Well, she's gone way past that. She says she wants to spend time with her 9 grandchildren. She's indicated that she may write her memoir. I hope that she does that. I actually have a personal theory. This is not based on actual information, but my personal theory is that it is possible that President Biden would appoint her as the ambassador to Italy or to the Vatican, to Italy, the land that her grandparents left not so very many years ago.
Hmm. How much would you say that Pelosi has been undervalued because she's a woman, or underestimated because she's a woman, and how much that has played a role in her career or her approach to gaining and wielding power? You know, people say things about women that they wouldn't say about men. People dismiss women in the way they wouldn't dismiss men. One of the callers, even to this segment, you know, critical of her, said she deserves a spanking. And I know he was talking in political terms, but you wonder if a guy would say that about a man who he disagreed with on something politically. So how does all that play into her approach? The subtitle of your book is Nancy Pelosi and the Lessons of Power. So what's a lesson in that respect?
Well, I think that sexism has definitely played a role in her career, of which she's aware. You know, there's only one political race that Nancy Pelosi ever lost, and that was in 1984-85 when she ran to be chair of the Democratic National Committee in the aftermath of the debacle that was the Mondale campaign. We remember, of course, Walter Mondale, who just passed away a few days ago. In that campaign, there was a lot of sexist talk about her. She was called an airhead. She was called a dilettante. She publicly blamed sexism for her defeat in that race, and she's never complained about it since. Publicly, she has. I think she decided that wasn't helpful, that she would just plow ahead. She applied the primary lesson that her father taught her. And here's how she articulates it. Nobody is going to give you power. You have to seize it. And that is how she has proceeded. That's the advice she's given other polls. There is one thing that I think sexism played a part in that does still annoy her, which is when she was elected Speaker of the House the first time, in 2007, the first woman in that role, Time magazine never put her on its cover. And as soon as John Boehner succeeded her as Speaker, the next week he was on the cover of the Time magazine with a big headline that said, Mr. Speaker.
Hmm. Dylan in Sweden, you're on WNYC. Hello, Dylan.
Oh, hello. I'm actually standing by the American Embassy, and it's snowing, so I apologize if it's a lot of...
It's snowing?
Windy. Yeah, it is, actually, today. But I'm trying to reframe this in a question, but it's more or less about the perspective of the right on Nancy. I used to remember so vivid, so strongly from the insurrection of, you know, Nancy Satan on a windshield of a truck, and just the cops and everyone standing by there for minutes and minutes and minutes and minutes. And also with, like, and it actually came up a couple of weeks ago, like how we spoke, how you spoke about Biden being dowish and Hillary Clinton being more like a hawkish person, and also with Kamala Harris being a pit bull. It's just kind of this, I'm just wondering if you portrayed this in the book, and also, yeah, how it perhaps will be talked about and remembered, and if it's just more something about the right, about how they frame women in our times today, or if, yeah, just kind of your perspective on, or, yeah, is that something you've seen also among, like, politicians?
Dylan, thank you. Susan?
Dylan, thank you, and I hope you're staying warm. It's hard to imagine to be there in the snow in Sweden. That's remarkable. Here, I would love to tell you briefly a story. I actually interviewed Nancy Pelosi last week. This wasn't for the book, obviously, but for USA Today, and it was the first time I'd had a chance to ask her about the events of January 6th. And she told me that, you know, she was up there presiding over the house when her security guard, one of them, came up and said, you have to leave, there's a problem. And she didn't think it was some big deal. She thought, she didn't take it too seriously, so much so that she left her phone up there because she thought she would step away and then immediately be coming back. Then they took her to a secure location, and she, like with all of us, watched on TV the horrific scenes of the Capitol of the United States being stormed by a mob. We saw them chanting her name, and we saw the pictures afterwards of the guy who put his boot up on her desk and left an obscene note for her on her desk. So I asked her last week, if they had caught you, would they have killed you? And she said, yes, that was what they were setting out to do. And then she said, but they would have had a battle on their hands because I'm a street fighter. And then she lifts up her foot. We're sitting in the speaker's suite. She lifts up her foot, points to her 4-inch stilettos, and says, besides, I could have used these as weapons.
Ooh. Yeah, it is Pelosi who they set out to kill. It's Gretchen Whitmer who they set out to kidnap, not Cuomo, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Roslyn and Bed-Stuy are on WNYC. Hi, Roslyn.
Roslyn, hi.
Roslyn, I'm sorry. Hi.
No problem. Listen, in terms of Madam Pelosi, some time ago she's had some challenges and conflicts with African-American women that are high profile in the party and hard workers. And they more or less were a little upset with her in terms of her selections. And I just hope, and I want to know, I just want to hope, what is her stance on promoting African-American women to take that next position after she leaves? And then my final question is that in your book, do you talk about her money and donations and her, you know, they accuse her of taking, you know, corporate monies and supporting their positions, which might not, you know, go along with the Democratic position.
Rosalind, thank you so much. And I think there's something in the news this week about her purchase of Microsoft stock. Is that a thing?
I don't know much about that. I had seen a conservative critic raise that issue, but it's not something I know well enough about to talk about.
But on her relationship with African-American women members.
Well, her relationship with African-American women members is generally good, although one of the complaints that AOC made at the point they were in a kind of a public dispute was AOC suggested she was singling out for criticism members of the squad who, of course, are women of color. That is not a – she is close to the Congressional Black Caucus. She has promoted some African-American women within the House. I'm thinking particularly, for example, of Val Demings, the congresswoman from Florida whom she put on the impeachment, made one of the impeachment managers. That was a very high profile position. And it was, I think, one reason Val Demings ended up on Joe Biden's short list for vice president. There is a, you know, there it is possible that she will be succeeded by an African-American woman as the leader of House Democrats. One name that is often talked about is Karen Bass, the congresswoman from California, who was formerly the speaker of the California Assembly. So she has some experience there. So it's not impossible that she'll be succeeded by a woman of color.
We have just 1 minute left. Let me ask you just one sort of overarching question on news of the day. There are so many things Pelosi could pass in the Democratic House, but that go to die in the 50-50 Senate. Is that affecting how she legislates? She could do lots of posing for purity pictures, as you said, she could call it herself, but to no avail, whether it's on climate bills or the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act or HR1 or economic things, a million other things.
Yeah. And of course, that's been the history, right, for the past 2 years, passing things in the House they don't pass in the Senate. She's very focused on getting this infrastructure bill through. And after that, the bill that would follow that will have more social programs in it. But she is, I think, pretty realistic about the prospects for getting a lot of different things done in a 50-50 Senate.
Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, her new book is called Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi and the Lessons of Power. Susan has some virtual book events coming up. If you want to hear more, one is from Cornell University at 7 p.m. on Thursday, May 6th, events.cornell.edu to sign up for that one. And Monday, May 10th at 8:30 p.m., a virtual book event with the Bay Area Bookstore Book Passage, bookpassage.com/event. Susan, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. So interesting. Congratulations on the book.
Brian, it's a privilege to be with you. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.